What's up? Welcome to the Plus Pitch Podcast, your morning starting pitcher podcast brought to you by PitcherList.com. My name is Jake Crumpler, and today is August 30th. Let's break down every single start from August 29th. We'll start it off with Matt Wilkinson, and nicknames are a quick way to enter the consciousness of baseball fans. But if it isn't supported by on-field success, those nicknames can just as quickly become something at which to poke fun. Matt Wilkinson, affectionately dubbed Tugboat, has been a staple in the baseball community without the prospect pedigree that usually accompanies an anticipated promotion. The Southpaw was a star in the 2015 Little League World Series, fanning 16 batters in his signature performance that year. At Central Arizona College in 2023, he earned NJCAA D1 Pitcher of the Year honors with a 1.07 ERA. He even pitched for Team Canada in the 2026 WBC, but he never really had those huge years in the minors or was drafted very highly by the Guardians to suggest that he was going to be a future stud in the majors. Traded to the Giants in exchange for Patrick Bailey earlier this year, Tugboat finally made his MLB debut in August, making a pair of relief appearances to little fanfare. With the Giants starting core in shambles due to injuries to three rotation regulars, Wilkinson was called upon to make his first MLB start in the matinee of the club's doubleheader on Friday. Hosting the Diamondbacks, he tossed six innings, allowing two earned runs with three hits, two walks, and four strikeouts. He induced six whiffs with 28% CSW across 90 pitches as he took the loss. As the 27th man, Wilkinson is expected to head right back to the minors after the start, but with openings in the rotation and rosters expanding in September, should we be buying our tickets to ride the Tugboat in this final month of the season? As with any lefty sporting a changeup, we're on hashtag swatch watch with Wilkinson. He pairs his 83 to 84 mile per hour changeup that he commands pretty well downstairs with a 90 to 91 mile per hour two plane four seamer that plays up due to his above average 6.7 feet of extension and flat attack angle embodied in his 1.5 Hava. The tertiary offerings are a slow sub 80 mile per hour slider and an 83 mile per hour cutter, which I think would be more accurately labeled sweepers and sliders respectively. Regardless, with a large and durable frame, he's 6'1" and 250 pounds, and he might be pushing past that at this point. He's got the build to be an MLB workhorse. Pitching with underwhelming velocity and without dominant stuff, though, Tugboat will be heavily reliant on his ability to command his pitches, mix speeds, and separate his locations. He didn't do enough of that to a degree that got me excited on Saturday enough to be willing to trust him as a streamer in all but the deepest of leagues. However, with a dope nickname, a fun story, and pitching for my hometown team, the Giants, I can't help but root for Tugboat to rally the baseball community behind him. Now let's see how every other starting pitcher did on Saturday, starting with Christopher Sanchez in LA against the Angels. He tossed seven shutout innings, allowing two hits with one walk and eight strikeouts. He induced 16 whiffs with 36% CSW to take home the golden goal as he led baseball with 16 whiffs and with 36% CSW. And this is what Sanchez is capable of when Koufax pats him on the back. With a golden goal keyed by changeup domination, he had 11 whiffs and 41% CSW on the slow ball. He wrapped up an impressive August during which he's pitched to a 1.72 ERA with a 1.15 whip and a 30% strikeout rate. This was Sanchez's best month outside of his scoreless May, which is crazy just to even say that. And yes, even at his best, Sanchez won't be a whip asset. That 1.15 whip, even at his best, is not spectacular. It's good, but it's not ace level production, and that's because of his reliance on the whims of BABIP. He's so reliant on ground balls, and those have a higher BABIP, and thus Sanchez is somebody who is prone to having a high BABIP or a high whip, but he will give you strikeouts, he'll give you wins, he'll give you innings, he'll give you a good ERA, and sometimes that's really awesome in the majority of leagues. Next, we have Merrill Kelly in San Francisco. He tossed seven scoreless innings, allowing two hits with four walks and seven strikeouts. From Holly to hipster, Kelly was once a reliable starter who we could count on to provide consistent yet unspectacular performances. Now he's unpredictable, living and dying by his feel for his changeup rather than the opponent he was facing. It was worth flipping the coin in Oracle Park. It's a good pitcher's park. The Giants lineup is awful right now. And as you'd expect, given the line, his slow ball induced used whiffs and earned plenty of strikes. It took a little help from Koufax with 13 outs on 15 balls in play, but Kelly was a ground ball machine with 67% grounders, and thus he deserved his success here. It's up to you if you want to flip the coin again with Merrill Kelly in Houston next. Next, we've got Nolan McLain versus the Astros. He tossed 7 shutout innings, allowing 2 hits with 3 walks and 4 strikeouts. And the man known for his breakers instead turned to a RazPak impersonator, throwing a trio of fastball variants 82% of the time. It's not like they performed well either, nor did he have any reason to give up on his off-speed offerings early on. This was especially confusing with McLain facing a right-handed batter heavy Astros lineup that would be perfectly suited to be vulnerable to McLain's horizontal movement on his breakers. Regardless, he induced a ton of weak contact and Koufax blew him a kiss, allowing him to return 17 outs on 19 balls in play while completing 7 frames for the 4th time this season. It may not make sense every single time from McLain. It never seems like he's got the best control or the best game plan, but he always seems to have enough stuff to get the job done, and he's been great all year because of it. Next, we have Jake Bennett in the Bronx. 6 shutout innings, 3 hits, no walks, and 7 strikeouts. When you see success from Bennett, you should know exactly what he did. And if you guessed that he successfully pulled off the Blake Snell blueprint with 4 seamers and changeups, you got it right. Even with a smaller velocity gap between the heater and slow ball, with the fastball coming in slower and the changeup coming in faster, they still combined for 9 whiffs and 4 strikeouts and received ample support from a sinker that lived around the edges to great effect with 47% CSW and 82% strikes. Bennett's command has been looking a lot better recently. It's looking like it did in July when he first broke out. So I think we're safe streaming him in the first half of September as he gets the Orioles in Baltimore, then hosts the Angels before heading to Arlington, Texas. I think Bennett will be a fine streamer over the next 3 weeks. Next, we have Cade Cavalli versus the Marlins. He tossed 4 scoreless innings with no hits, 3 walks, and 8 strikeouts, and well on his way to another dominant performance with 8 punchouts across 4 hitless frames. Cavalli was struck in the ankle by a comebacker and was forced to leave the game. Let's hope he's good to make his next start, because it'll be a real test of his skills as he's forced to audition for acedom in Hollywood. That's Cade Cavalli. Next, we have Carmen Majinski in St. Louis. 3 1/3 scoreless innings, 1 hit, no walk, and 2 strikeouts, and pitching in bulk relief of Lake Backer, Majinski threw 7 different pitches to record 10 outs. I think if I were in his shoes, I'd probably only be able to throw 2 pitches, balls or home runs. Next, we've got Zach Agnes in Atlanta. 2 2/3 innings, no earned, 2 hits, 1 walk, and 1 strikeout. And this was a Rockies bullpen game, and I think that sentence speaks for itself. Let's move on to Martin Perez on the opposite side versus the Rockies. 5 2/3 innings, 1 earned, 5 hits, 2 walks, and 6 strikeouts. And facing Rocky Road, Perez didn't need to be perfect to keep his season-long Vargas role rolling, so he took his foot off the gas and threw 45% changeups. Despite a sub-60% strike rate, the slow ball induced 11 whiffs and racked up 6 punchouts, while his trio of fastball variants and surprise curveball kept hitters off balance all game. I was in a boat all day, and I'm still experiencing the sensation of swaying water. It's actually like really disorienting right now. So I know exactly how those Rockies hitters were feeling facing Martin Perez on Saturday. Next, we've got Cater Montero versus the Dodgers. 5 1/3 innings, 1 earned, 4 hits, 1 walk, and 3 strikeouts. And sometimes the toughest matchup can light a fire under anyone. I doubt anyone was starting Whip Merchant Montero against the mighty Dodgers, but if you did, props to you, because he came through. He was a weak contact machine and returned 13 outs on 17 balls in play as a result. Montero isn't your typical Koufax-reliant ground ball guy, though, which is what you think of when you have a low strike rate or low strikeout rate and a low whip. His BABIP should be lower than most pitchers who are heavily reliant on batted balls, because he's a fly ball pitcher who excels at producing weak pop-ups and cans of corn. Fly balls generally have a lower BABIP. They're much more likely to be caught than ground balls, which can sneak through the infield often. I can't say I know what it is about Montero's stuff that allows him to do that, though. So he is somebody that I'm generally avoiding, though. He's great in 15-teamers this year. Next, we have Bailey Ober versus the White Sox. 5 innings, 1 earned, 2 hits, 2 walks, and 5 strikeouts. Ober showcased his highest fastball velocity of the second half. Guess how fast it was? 82.7 miles per hour. Wait, no, that was his changeup. Honest mistake there. His fastball clocked in at an eye-watering 87.5 miles per hour. I don't care that Ober has a lead extension and succeeds from time to time. There's no way I'm trusting the softest tossing starter in the majors, not even in a rematch on the south side of Chicago next. Next, we've got Blake Snell in Detroit. He tossed five innings, allowing one earned with three hits, three walks, and 10 strikeouts. He induced 16 whiffs for a co-share of the gallows pole. And in four starts since returning from the injured list, Snell hasn't allowed more than one run. If he's not pulling off the Blake Snell blueprint and earning a co-share of the gallows pole, then baseball's broken. Right now, baseball is working. Hot Snell summer isn't ending anytime soon, and it'll continue through September as well, as I am set to travel to Paris to experience hot snail summer. Next, we have Jack Perkins versus the Orioles. He tossed five innings, allowing one earned with four hits, four walks, and five strikeouts. Perkins had a rare moment of surviving Sacre Verde. While it took him stranding six of the eight base runners he allowed an unearned run here. He made a couple of pitch usage adjustments that might be interesting in the future. I like seeing Perkins lean on cutters instead of four-seamers, especially with four-seamers sitting a tick down and continuing to showcase lackluster attributes. The cutter could be the key to neutralizing left-handed batters, taking pressure off his inconsistent changeup. Nonetheless, he's still a sweeper-focused righty with poor control and a terrible home park. He's maybe worth streaming in Seattle if you're looking for strikeouts in deep leagues. That's Jack Perkins. Next, we have Shane Drohan versus the Rangers. Five innings, one earned, six hits, one walk, and six strikeouts. Why are we cutting back on the cutter that made us feel more confident in you, particularly when facing a right-handed batter heavy Rangers lineup? Drohan was somebody who showcased a heavier reliance on a RAS pack with more cutter usage that had him rising up the list, making him seem like a trustworthy streamer. He didn't do that here. It still worked. It didn't matter, but he was a little too sinker happy for my liking. He has no reason to be throwing that pitch a third of the time while throwing 77% of his pitches against right-handed batters. Drohan is a lefty. You do not want to be throwing sinkers a bunch to opposite-handed hitters, especially when you have a four-seamer and curveball and cutter that are reliable. Johan's command wasn't great either, and I think a stronger lineup punishes him for being so reliant on aggression out of the zone. He gets the Reds back-to-back in his next two starts, and they might be weak enough to let him skate by unimpeded without improving his approach. Next, we have Ryan Johnson versus the Phillies. Five innings, one earned, two hits, five walks, and two strikeouts. And you should be asking yourself what Johnson would have to do to get you interested. Oh, you're waiting for my answer. I was generally interested in your opinion. It certainly isn't more than the twice as many walks as strikeouts and the reduced velocity that across the board that we saw in this one. That cutter and slower cutter with a volatile splitter approach is unique, but not in a good way. Ryan Johnson is not somebody that intrigues me. Next, we have Junior Marte versus the Diamondbacks. Four and two-thirds innings, one earned, three hits, two walks, and three strikeouts. And Marte has never started a game at the major league level, and his last one came at AAA in 2021 when he was first in the Giants organization. After taking a tour of MLB and NPB, he's back in San Francisco to start the second half of a doubleheader with a lead extension, an uninspiring 93 to 94 mile per hour four-seamer, and not much else to support it besides a decent 85 mile per hour slider. I understand why Junior Marte has been kept hidden in the bullpen throughout his career. Next, we'll talk about Max Fried, Kyle Leahy, Shane Boz, and the rest of the pitchers who pitched on Saturday. But first, we're going to take a quick break here on the Plus Pitch Podcast. And we're back. Jake Crumpler here, breaking down every single start from August 29th. We'll resume with Max Fried versus the Red Sox. He tossed three and two-thirds innings, allowing one earned, three hits, one walk, and four strikeouts. And in his return from an IL stint necessitated by an elbow bone bruise, Fried was limited as expected. He threw just 63 pitches. What wasn't expected was an arsenal-wide velocity drop. I think I'm just going to write this one off. It's just a still ill across the board. I don't think it's worth looking at what Fried did here and evaluating how we feel about him moving forward. We know what Fried can do when he's fully stretched out, when he's in a rhythm. And I think I just want to give him one more start to expand his workload before we trust him as an elite Holly throughout the rest of September. Next, we have Kyle Leahy versus the Pirates. He tossed three innings, allowing one earned with four hits, one walk, and three strikeouts. And Leahy was on quite the run before the Cardinals abruptly decided to limit his pitch count for the rest of the season, yielding a chorus of groans from fantasy managers who had benefited from his sub-2 ERA and 26% strikeout rate across his previous 12 starts. Leahy is not worth chasing if he's only going to throw 50 to 60 pitches per outing, because he won't pitch long enough to qualify for a win. He won't rack up counting stats. Excuse me. And he won't impact your ratios. Sorry about that. Still getting over a cold. Do not want to cough on the mic. Next, we have Shane Baz in Sacramento. He tossed 5 2/3 innings, allowing two earned with five hits, three walks, and four strikeouts. Baz had Sacre Verde in the palm of his hand with five scoreless frames, but he lost his command in the sixth, issuing a pair of walks, surrendering a pair of singles, and hitting a batter to chase him from the game. That's a careful Icarus in my books. I appreciated Baz's willingness to cordon off his fastballs based on the handedness he was facing with sinkers versus right-handed batters and four-seamers versus left-handed batters, but his curveball command wasn't good enough with just 50% strikes, and he was unwilling to allow cutters to take center stage. It was a tough environment, so I'll keep Baz in the questionable start tier moving forward. Next, we have Eric Fetty in Minnesota. He tossed five innings, allowing two earned with three hits, two walks, and four strikeouts. And Fetty actually had pretty great pitch separation here. He was commanding his entire arsenal. And even with his best command, this is what the peak looks like. And that's not even an exaggeration. I think he's only eclipsed this amount of whiffs one time. He had nine whiffs here. He's only had 10 whiffs one time, never greater than 10. And I think he's only pitched more than five innings in four starts this year. Fetty is a guy who inspires us to say, don't trust the feds. Next, we have Foster Griffin versus the Royals. Five innings, two earned, four hits, one walk, and four strikeouts. And just three times this year has Foster Griffin allowed more than two earned runs in consecutive starts. He allowed four and three earned runs in mid-April, nine and five earned runs in back-to-back starts in mid-May, and then had three straight starts of three runs, six runs, and five runs on the July-August turn. In every other start this year, he's produced a 1.53 ERA, a 0.96 whip, and a 23% strikeout rate. Those are very cherry-picked numbers, but they speak not only to Griffin's consistency this year, but also to his ability to quickly address league-wide adjustments, recover his command when it isn't clicking, and bounce back from rough stretches. He's a Toby worth holding through the end of the year. Next, we have Carlos Rodon versus the Red Sox. He tossed 4 2/3 innings, allowing two earned, three hits, one walk, and five strikeouts. He induced 16 whiffs. And for the second consecutive day, we had a three-way share of the Gallows poll with 16 whiffs. That's pretty interesting. Maybe only for pitching nerds like me and you guys. Rodon was cruising through four frames and found himself with two outs in the fourth pretty quickly, but then it all fell apart. A single put two men on, a wild pitch scored one, a walk added another base runner, and a hit by pitch loaded the bases. Ultimately, it was a 27 pitch fifth frame that knocked Rodon out of the game and showcased his struggles putting batters away throughout the game. A 74% two strike rate and a Gallows pull should equal a boatload of strikeouts, but he was unable to sequence effectively to get those much needed swings and misses in advantage counts. Rodon is still trying to find a rhythm after spending so much of the year on the IL. I think he's going to get there, but it may be a couple more starts. Next, we have Cade Anderson in Toronto, 4 1/3 innings, two earned, three hits, three walks, and three strikeouts. And start number two is in the books. Anderson actually exhibited increased velocity despite the lack of adrenaline from his debut, sitting 94 plus miles per hour with his heater, which had improved but only because he was pitching in a domed stadium. So don't get too excited about that. The most promising aspect of Anderson's game has been his elite command, which gives him a stable floor that's not only raised by his handedness, that's only raised by his handedness. As a lefty, you've got a higher floor because southpaws are just better. He was inefficient in two strike counts here, going 0-for-10 on putting batters away with his slider, and he'll need to get the breaker below the zone to induce the whiffs necessary to record strikeouts and end at bats early to make the most of his allotted 80 to 85 pitches. I like Anderson's ability to command at such a young portion of his career. I don't know his age, but in two starts, showing the command that he's had this far is really promising. He's got the potential to be a Holly. I don't think he's going to be a huge strikeout arm, but as a swatch with above average stuff and really good command, I think Anderson's going to be somebody who's going to be pretty solid, at least for the rest of the year and into 2027, but it's not going to be exciting, and there's definitely going to be some growing pains. There is a shag rug. Next, we have Daniel Lynch, the fourth in Cleveland, 3 1/3 innings, 2 earned, 3 hits, 2 walks, and 3 strikeouts. In one of my least favorite experiments of the season, the Royals continue to stretch Lynch out to rejoin the rotation. Maybe there's swatch potential here if he can find some actual support for his changeup, but the neckbeard approach with diminished stuff in an expanded role isn't my cup of coffee. I like a lot of cream and sugar, and this is like an Americano with tap water, instant coffee, and no additions. Next, we have Jose Soriano versus the Mariners. He tossed 7 innings, allowing 3 earned with 5 hits, with 2 walks and 6 strikeouts. Soriano's best attribute is his durability. He's tied for 10th in MLB with 27 starts and is inside the top 20 qualified starters with 93 pitches per game this year. If he's throwing strikes, he'll make the most of his availability and his long leash, going 7 innings like he did on Saturday. He did so here, returning 69% overall strikes while living downstairs with everything. Unlike your weird uncle who lives in your great aunt's basement, staying downstairs is pretty cool, as long as Soriano switches it up with some surprise four-seamers upstairs to hunt strikeouts, as he did twice here. So I'm game with Soriano. It's just not going to be what we saw from him in April. Next, we have Cal Quantrill in Milwaukee. 6 innings, 3 earned, 4 hits, no walks, and 8 strikeouts. Is it really a continuation of Quantrill's Vargas rule if he returned a poor quality start? He did fan 8 batters for the first time since June 2024 and has induced double-digit whiffs in 3 of his last 4 starts. So fine, it's a very tough pill to swallow because we can never attempt to figure out the unquantifiable, but this is a true Vargas rule that deserves some respect with unintimidating matchups versus the Rays and in Seattle across the next 2 weeks. Next, we have Nick Martinez versus the Padres. 6 innings, 3 earned, 7 hits, no walks, and 4 strikeouts. And speaking of a Vargas rule, Martinez continued his with a poor quality start of his own. Uninspiring, right? That's sort of how it's felt all year. And if you're really paying attention, he's stumbling to the finish line. Martinez's last 6 starts have produced a 4.71 ERA, a 1.10 whip, and a 17% strikeout rate. The whip is serviceable, but there are 3 other categories to account for: wins, ERAs, and strikeouts. And I'll put it this way. If you're holding on to Cater Montero in your league, then Martinez is worth holding. If not, then probably not. Next, we have Walker Buehler in Tampa Bay. 5 innings, 3 earned, 7 hits, no walks, and 3 strikeouts. Buehler had 5 frames of 2-run ball under his belt, was sent out for the 6th, served up a dinger to the dangerous Junior Caminero in a 7-pitch battle, and then promptly received a hook. Where's the conviction? If you're going to send him out for the 5th, give him more than one tough batter before calling it quits. He did have just 1 whiff, not in that at bat, the whole game. And now I'm starting to say, why didn't he get pulled earlier, and starting to question my own conviction. Next, we have Christian Javier in Queens, 4 1/3 innings, 3 earned, 6 hits, no walks, and 4 strikeouts. And Javier caught my eye with a gallows pull via 21 whiffs in his last start, but it didn't come with positive results. So I was pumped to see what he did in his encore. 13 whiffs here with Bennett Sousa opening. There was an increased chance of a win. We were somewhat let down though, as a difficult 5th frame facing the order for the 2nd time produced damaging results, as Javier kept getting beat on well-placed pitches. The silver lining is that the 13 whiffs were still flowing and he showcased increased velocity across the board. Javier looks more like a peas this year, a poor execution, awesome stuff. And I'm willing to watch from afar in September before making him a late round high upside pick in 2027 drafts. Next, we have Mitch Bratt in San Francisco, 4 1/3 innings, 3 earned, 3 hits, 2 walks, and 2 strikeouts. And Bratt was called upon to make a spot start in the 2nd half of a doubleheader in San Francisco. And it's possible he was distracted by his post-game plans at the Pokemon World Championships being held in San Francisco as he sat 1-2 ticks down and threw 71% four-seamers. It seemed like he was like, all right, let's get this over with. I got places to be, and I don't blame you, Mitch. Those scalpers do not sleep. It is hard to get your hand on some Pokemon merch, but don't check out my collector app. I got an insane amount of Pokemon cards. Next, we've got Sandy Alcantara in our nation's capital. Six innings, four and eight hits, one walk, and three strikeouts. And I was so excited about the Sandy versus Cavalli matchup, but Cade got hurt and Alcantara got singled out for all four runs in the third. He struggled to find a put-away pitch all game, returning a mere 21% put-away rate, leading to a heavier reliance on batted balls than you like to see. I'm willing to write off the results here, but Alcantara has struggled to fan batters consistently, striking out three or fewer in three of his last four starts. He really needs a more intentional approach in two strike counts rather than just a kitchen sink of surprise. You've got overwhelming stuff. Blow a heater by them, rip off a nasty sweeper or a changeup, bust them inside with a sinker or a cutter. And now I'm starting to understand that he might be overwhelmed with the amount of options that he has to put batters away with. And maybe that is the problem with Alcantara. He's got too many offerings, and none of which are that one signature pitch that he needs to be putting batters away with. I think it should be the changeup versus left-handed batters at the very least, and we need to see more high four-seamers. Next, we have Brian Bayo in the Bronx. Four and a third innings, four and five hits, one walk, and two strikeouts. Alec Gamboa opened for Bayo, and Koufax closed the deal. This was terrible luck. All five hits against Bayo were singles. Four out of the six base runners came around to score, and the official scorer didn't award him any unearned runs despite an error during a three-run third. I'm writing this off and finding hope in the 2.14 ERA, 0.95 whip, and 20% strikeout rate that Bayo has produced since returning from the minors. Second to last, we've got Kevin Gausman versus the Reds. Five innings, five earned, six hits, two walks, and seven strikeouts. And Gausman should be better than this. He's rarely gotten the muted BABIP that comes with pitching for the Cubs, and he's found it difficult to avoid the long ball. It's hard to defend him when he's throwing 1-2 ticks slower and throwing all of his fastballs in the heart of the plate, though. He's a step below a premier cherry bomb at this point, and I'd be thinking of him along the same vein as Kyle Bradish, but with a clearer path to success. This is a guy who has proven that he can be good. He's been good this year. He's got a very high strikeout potential. I think any start, it could click again and he could go on a run. I'm holding and starting him with Milwaukee times two up next, but I do understand that there is some risk with Gausman, especially with the way he's been pitching recently. Lastly, we've got Andrew Abbott on the north side of Chicago. Three innings, seven earned, eight hits, two walks, and just one strikeout. And the only thing that makes me okay with this dry bread, how am I supposed to butter my bread with just one strikeout, is the funny pitcher gami that accompanied this line. Nobody has produced this exact pitching line since Andrew Abbott himself on April 12th. This was a perfect warning flag for Abbott's upcoming schedule as he'll face the Brewers before he gets the Dodgers back-to-back, and I don't want any part of that with Andrew Abbott. That's every single start from August 29th. Now let's look at our game of the day for August 30th. We got Logan Gilbert versus Max Scherzer. Scherzer doesn't have many starts left in his career, and he's just nine strikeouts shy of Gaylord Perry for ninth all-time. I don't think he's going to get there in this start, but it's worth watching in the instance that he does. He'll have a pretty darn good pitcher to square off against in ace Logan Gilbert. But that'll do it for this episode of the Plus Pitch Podcast. Make sure to head on over to pitcherlist.com to check out the article that accompanies this podcast, the SP Roundup. You can also sign up for PL Plus or PL Pro to gain access to all of the incredible features we have on the site, as well as gaining access to the Discord where you can talk with PitcherList staff and the rest of the PitcherList community. You can follow me on socials at Jake Crumpler, where I do daily SP streamers and I break down every single start via the PitcherList stats player cards. And you can listen to me on the First Pitch Podcast, the In the Pen Podcast, and find more of my work over at baseballhq.com. But that's going to do it for this episode of the Plus Pitch Podcast. We'll break down every single starter once again tomorrow.